I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A door-to-door search is underway in Granbury, Texas, just outside of Fort Worth, where seven people are unaccounted for, at least six dead, after several tornadoes touched down last night. And a mile-wide tornado tore through the nearby town of Cleburne. Emily Trube of KRLD in Dallas is in Cleburne. Emily, what are you seeing?
So much destruction. Entire houses are missing. Others have just large parts missing. There are many places where garages used to be, and all that's left are the cars. This thing came in with a lot of force, and people really had to scramble very quickly to get to a safe room. And in many cases, that was a bathroom or a closet, so entire families kind of hunkering down inside the safe place while the tornado moved through. The storm developed very quickly. No one expected it to be as forceful as it was, and there just simply wasn't enough time to get to an outside shelter.
You're saying not enough time, but do people feel there was enough warning? Maybe if the storm came up so quickly, there couldn't be.
You're exactly right. The storm came up too quickly for as much warning as officials would like to give.
Yeah.
They did give warning, a lot of it, but it just popped up very, very quickly. We had a similar situation last year about this time. Not too far from here with the storm. We thought it was going to be one thing, and then, holy cow, we have a tornado that's enormous that is about to touch down.
Well, tell us some of the stories that you're hearing. Thankfully, some of them are of survival.
Absolutely. It's amazing that no one was killed here in Cleburne. One little boy I talked to, he hid with his grandmother in her bathroom at the back of the house. And it's incredible because that bathroom is about the only thing left standing in the house. The roof was ripped off. The garage was ripped off of its foundation. Walls are missing. And he said it was very, very loud. He said it sounded like a blender. And he described how the pressure dropped and he could feel his ears pop. And he was terrified, but ready to help clean up. I've noticed that with a lot of the little children who live in this neighborhood, which surrounds an elementary school, their elementary school, which is also badly damaged, and they're out there trying to help pick things up. I saw a little bitty boy dressed still in his pajamas. He had on superhero pajamas, pulling his red wagon behind him. He wanted to help.
Well, there you are in Cleburne. Thankfully, as you said, no fatalities. In Granbury, another story. We know six people confirmed dead there, several missing. I know you're not in Granbury, but is there a sense that those people might have been with family? Because earlier today we heard 15 people missing. So is there a sense that perhaps some of these people still missing might be safe somewhere? What are you hearing?
There is a possibility. They're in the area, rescuers, searchers, trying to find folks. The area where this struck in Granbury had a lot of trailer homes, which were crushed like tin cans. And then a lot of housing that was built by Habitat for Humanity not too long ago. And those houses were just completely flattened.
Yeah.
So it may take a while to do a search, but certainly everybody is very hopeful.
Emily Trube of KRLD in Dallas, speaking to us from Cleburne, Texas, after last night's tornadoes. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Sound caught last night in Texas by a group of storm chasers who came from Oklahoma, including Paige Burris, meteorology major at the University of Oklahoma. Paige, you were in Cleburne. What did you see?
I mean, it started as a wall of rain. Suddenly, the rain just kind of wrapped around, and this large tornado emerged from the rain, and that's all we could see.
How close were you? What are you thinking at that point?
At that point, we were probably about 5 miles from it. We were at a safe distance. We thought it was going to move towards us, and we were preparing to move south if we needed to.
In your case, you're studying, but also you're reporting. What is it you wanted to get out to people?
As soon as we saw it, we wanted to let people know that this was a very large and dangerous tornado and that they needed to seek shelter.
And again, what does it feel like to be right there in its path?
It's a sobering experience when you see it, this large tornado coming at you. You know that it's probably devastating someone's lives, and you can't do anything about it.
Paige Burris, a meteorology student at the University of Oklahoma, one of several storm chasers who went to Texas last night to help track those tornadoes. Paige, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We've spoken here before about the huge failures in mental health care, how the thinking starting in the 60s was to move away from warehousing the mentally ill in often medieval psychiatric institutions to mainstreaming them with the help of new medications and new community mental health centers. While the medications came, the community centers did not. Budget cuts also meant fewer beds in regular hospitals. The result, often the only way to get help for a severely mentally ill family member who's unraveling, is to call the police, which some families are afraid to do. But if the family member acts out, someone else will call the police and they may end up in jail. Mother Jones reporter Mac McClellan writes about how this pattern impacted her own family with tragic consequences. Her 22-year-old cousin Houston was seeing a psychiatrist and on medication, but becoming increasingly violent. His parents asked the psychiatrist what to do. He told them to call the police. They didn't want to. We want to ask Mac to pick up the story from there. Mac, why didn't your Uncle Mark, Houston's dad, want to call the police?
Well, because he reads the news, and so he knew that in the city where they lived, they're from Santa Rosa, California, there had been several instances in the last few years where the police had been called to intervene with someone who was mentally ill, and the person who was mentally ill ended up dead. You know, if you're a father who's trying to figure out what to do with your kid, and you're Googling it, you find out that advocates think that the mentally ill are four times more likely to be seriously injured in some sort of altercation with the police. And so he said, we're not doing that because I don't want him to get shot,
yeah,
basically.
Well, and we should say that there are cities with SWAT teams who only deal with the mentally ill, have had many more successes, but Portland, Oregon police, the Justice Department found had a pattern of excessive force against the mentally ill. And in some cases, I'm thinking of a story in Ithaca, New York. In that case, advocates even called it suicide by cop, a mentally ill person who might even have wanted the police to kill him and provoke them, and police didn't know how to deal with it. So there's just all sorts of, you know, problems around this issue.
Yeah, well, it's not their job, really. Yeah. That's not what the police are for. And so they're not trained mental health professionals. It's not their profession. And so a lot of times those situations get out of control because nobody knows exactly what the right thing to do is. And even people who are trained for their whole lives to work in those kinds of crisis situations with a person who's in psychosis and is incredibly hard to deal with, bad things can happen even in those cases. So you can imagine with people who don't know what they're doing.
Well, this is what Houston's father was realizing, back to this, you know, really terrible story. The father, had written a note on his calendar, get Houston help, had written a prayer asking for help from his son, but it came to a pretty awful end. What happened?
Unfortunately, the devolution of Houston's mental state came to a head in the way that it often does during this one very serious psychotic break. And unfortunately, his psychotic break involved very violent delusions. And he came home one night. He was having these voices and these ideas that his dad was the source of this terrible evil that was poisoning everything around it. And he stabbed him to death.
Mm. Yeah. Just a terrible, terrible story. And it may be rare, but a lot of parents live with the fear.
Sure. Of course, the very vast majority of mentally ill people will never hurt anybody. And if they do hurt somebody, they will hurt themselves. Mm-hmm. And I didn't go into this story knowing this, but as I reported it, the more public defenders, the more caseworkers, the more lawyers that I talked to were telling me, oh yeah, this happens all the time. When a person has a psychotic break like that and it turns out to be violent, the parents are almost always the victims. And so here just across San Francisco Bay in Contra Costa County, I talked to the chief public defender there and she said, I can't even tell you how many times I've heard this exact same story where you have parents who know that there's something wrong with their kid. They're trying to find them psychiatric services. They can't. In California, you know, half the counties don't have psych facilities, so they can't find help, and then one of them ends up dead or in an attempted murder situation, something like that. So it actually is not that rare of a tragedy, sadly.
Well, and this is because there aren't enough beds, there aren't facilities, there are psychiatrists who know how to dole out pills, but in often case there's no therapy or work that goes with that. Again, this is not in every instance, but enough that it's a big concern. And it's interesting because you say you didn't go into the story to write about this. Your assignment was to write about the $4.5 billion in budget cuts in state mental health in recent years. But of course, it brings you to your own family story, not just the tragedy of your cousin and his father, Houston, and Houston's now in jail. We'll get back to that. But you pick up the breadcrumbs from him back to your aunt. This is your mother's sister, your Aunt Terry, diagnosed with schizophrenia in 1977, and you realize, in understanding more about her story, how much more was available then.
Way more services, right. She actually was the one that I'd started out with because I knew that her break had been sort of at the tail end of deinstitutionalization, so they were just starting to shut down all the psych hospitals. And my mother, I remembered my mother telling me this story when her sister, my Aunt Terry, who I saw, you know, at least once a month at all kinds of family gatherings, when she had her psychotic break, it was in my mom's backyard, and she was just a teenager. But at the time, there were psych hospitals, and so she dragged her into this psych hospital, now closed, and was able to get help from various different facilities for years and years, because that was how you did it back then. Now, you know that you need to go to a regular hospital if you're having a heart attack or something, but what do you do when someone's having a psychotic break?
Tell us more about what happened back then, because, and I disclosed this before as someone who's dealt with a relative with mental illness, I was astonished to see your aunt had a social worker several days a week for 23 years.
She did, because the county where my family lives was decently funded. They had a decently funded mental health board, and they have enough caseworkers to take on the number of mentally ill patients that they have. So my aunt had her own place, and my family obviously helped take care of her a lot also, but she was pretty independent because she had this caseworker who stopped by one or two times a week, took her grocery shopping, took her to the park, just took her out, took her to get her medications, which she got in the form of injections. So she was a real lifeline. Yeah. And you don't have to have a person in an institution. You know, my Aunt Terry was about as delusional as you can get. She was about as severely schizophrenic as a person can be. She could never have held a job, but she still managed to be incredibly independent outside of an institution with just kind of a few number of resources in place, really.
But that was back then in the 70s. Now, as you write, the mentally ill are increasingly living in jail. We're going to take a break and hear more. And by the way, as always, if this is resonating with you, please let us know at hereandnow.org. Share any insights you might have to share with other people there as well. And we'll have more with Mother Jones reporter Mac McClelland, including what happened to Cousin Houston, accused of killing his father. What is the end of that story? That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Mother Jones reporter Mac McClelland about how the criminal justice system intersects with mental health, prisons becoming de facto mental institutions. Her schizophrenic cousin, accused of killing his father, is being held in one prison. And Mac, remind us, starting in the 60s, as we said, states began closing their psychiatric hospitals.
California was the pioneer in deinstitutionalization. Under Reagan, they were the first ones to pass the legislation that got everybody out of the institutions, which in theory was a really good idea, but they were supposed to have another option for these people. Nobody was saying they don't need any treatment. They were just saying they don't need to get it in this lockup style facility where they are now. And so the community mental health centers that were supposed to take the place of those institutions never materialized. And so a year after the legislation to deinstitutionalize went into effect in California, the number of mentally ill patients in prisons and jails in California doubled.
It's astonishing. In this county jail in Sonoma, the mentally ill population went up 3,650% in the last 20 years.
Yeah, because there's no place else for people to go, and they end up, when they're totally neglected and they're not getting treatment, they end up committing crimes sometimes. And so the Sonoma County Jail, like most jails, has become basically a mental institution.
Well, what is happening in the Sonoma County jail system? It's almost as if they're morphing along with their population.
They have three levels of mental health wards in that jail based on the severity of your illness. That's how serious it's gotten, is that they have no choice but to adapt. And they are doing their best. They are definitely instituting as many programs as they can. They have a lot of volunteers. They have a lot of classes. They have local mental health advocates come in and work with the inmates there. They have them on medications, though they don't have therapy for everyone. They have a little bit of therapy there. But again, this is a jail.
Yeah, well,
it's not a mental health facility.
I know. They have animal-assisted therapy. You write the corrections deputy even joined NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. He seems particularly devoted. It seems as if we've come full circle, that the mentally ill are warehoused and institutionalized once again.
Well, yeah, this is why they started building psych hospitals, right? Is because Dorothea Dix walked into the basement of a jail and saw that there were, you know, quote-unquote lunatics caged in the jails. And now we have as many people in jails that are mentally ill as, you know, than ever before.
We've reported here that there are things that can reduce the need for prison stay. Most states have court-ordered assisted outpatient treatment, forcing patients to have treatment at home. Six states don't, but backers say that ordering this treatment at home decreases incarcerations. But you've got places like, you quote a sheriff in Summit County, Ohio. He is the first in the country to refuse to accept more mentally ill. Some of the prisons are putting their foot down.
Yeah, and there was another sheriff of a jail in Illinois who threatened to sue the state for making him basically the largest mental health provider in the state because, as he was saying, we're not set up to do that. It's not our job. And because we're not supposed to be doing that and we don't know how to do that, bad things sometimes happen. One of the reasons that the sheriff in Summit County did that is because they had an incident and an inmate ended up dead. And that's been the case in lots of jails and prisons where you have suicides and attacks on guards and attacks on inmates who are having some sort of break and the guards don't know how to handle it and everything escalates and somebody ends up dead. So it's not a good situation for anyone.
But it was chilling to read that while in Summit County, Ohio, the sheriff is saying no more mentally ill, that county is supposed to be one that's very progressive as far as trying to keep people out of jail. They have mental health courts and other things that are specialized. They get recognition for that, and yet you still have a sheriff in that county saying no more.
That county passed a property tax levy to make up for the funds that they had lost, the funds that everyone's been having cut. So they actually do have a more hands-on program and more funding than most places. But that sheriff still thinks that this is a key issue. And so he was the first one. And a lot of people think he won't be the last one to say, I'm not doing this anymore. We're not taking mentally ill. It's your job as a society to figure out something better to do.
And meanwhile, your cousin Houston, in prison, is he getting treatment? What are his prospects?
He gets meds. He's not getting therapy, but he is on antipsychotics. And actually, his murder trial is going on as we're speaking right now. The first phase of it is already over. That was last week when the jury decided what the charges were. They gave him murder in the first degree, the worst thing that he could have gotten. And the second phase of the trial is where they decide whether or not he was insane. And three psychiatrists, two of them ordered by the court, evaluated him at length and said that he was schizophrenic and that's why he did what he did and that he was psychotic when he did it. But there was another psychiatrist retained by the DA's office who said that he's not insane. And so at this point, it's basically a battle of the experts, and it depends on how the jury feels.
What does your family want?
They want him to get treatment. my uncle's sister and his ex-wife and his daughter, my other cousin Savannah, Houston's sister, was there actually when this happened, and she unfortunately witnessed some of it, and she's the one who called the police. All of these people who are obviously devastated over the loss of Mark still really believe that Houston is sick. They're not out for blood, you know. They want him to get the treatment that he needs.
That's Mac McClelland. Mac, thanks so much for speaking with us, and we'd love to know the outcome.
Okay, thanks for having me. I'll let you know.
Terrible, terrible story. And as always, your thoughts, if it's resonating with you, at herenow.org. Still ahead, we'll speak with the president of the historically all-black Morehouse College as President Obama heads there to give the commencement speech this weekend. Latest news is next, Here and Now. Today, the ceiling of a Cambodian factory that makes ASICS sneakers collapsed on workers, killing at least two and injuring seven. It's sure to add to the international call for better safety standards. Of course, 3 weeks ago, that huge complex collapsed in Dhaka, Bangladesh, killing more than 1,100, a horrifying story. We want to check in there with the BBC's Akbar Hussein. He joins us from Dhaka. Akbar, we saw the dramatic rescue of that woman last week, but we know the search for survivors is over at the former site. And people are still going there with pictures of their loved ones who they say are still missing. Now, you say 200 other factories in the area are going to reopen tomorrow. They were closed because workers were protesting. So is that reopening expected to go smoothly?
There is a bone of contention between the labor organizations and the factory owners, because the factory owners say they are not going to pay the salary and other benefits for last few days when the factories are shut down. Government is in the middle. They are trying to convince the factory owners to reopen the factories because, you know, the garment sector, it is the lifeline for Bangladesh's economy, and it earns $20 billion every year. I mean, for it exporting garment to the foreign countries.
Well, this is quite something. I mean, we understand at the actual site where the collapse was, their bulldozers are still clearing it out. But as you say, these 250 factories that have been closed because of labor unrest will be opening. With still this unrest, we know these workers, some of them made just above the national minimum wage, which is about $38 a month. And they're demanding, in some cases, days for when the factories were shut in salary, but some are demanding at least 4 months in salary.
This is one thing, the salary issue. Now the question is the ensuring safety in the workplace. I mean, many people are saying many things, many organizations are many things. There is no central command, actually.
Mm-hmm. What is the status of the investigation into the Rana Plaza building? This was the huge collapse. The owners were vilified before the collapse. They'd been telling workers that a huge cracking sound they heard was nothing. And then, of course, the building fell. And officials are now saying that the owners illegally added floors and allowed factories to install heavy equipment that the building wasn't designed to support. So you've got the factory owners installing this heavy equipment, and you've got the building owners maybe not monitoring the health of the building. What's happened to them?
All of them, except one, have been arrested because the charges brought against the building owner is that the building owner, he didn't actually follow the rules and regulation of the construction. The building owner, in collaboration with the factory owner, they forced the worker to get inside the building, even it was dangerous. I mean, the industrial police, they detected the fault of the building, and they requested the building owner and the factory owners to evacuate the building, but they didn't follow that.
What about the 250 factories just reopening? Do the workers there think that their buildings are that much safer? I mean, what's the mood of the workers going back into these buildings with this huge gaping crater where another building used to be?
I mean, government workers, they are in general very scared about the latest incident. Many factories, I should say the more than 70% factories, they are not actually following the rules and regulations set by the government. I mean, the laborers who are working in the government sector, they are saying that the first priority is now the safe working place for them.
Well, and speaking of that, this week a number of European retailers signed a pledge, a binding agreement, that they'd have independent monitoring of these factories, foreign factories that make their products. But we've reported on this before and understand that a lot of American apparel makers already think they have independent monitoring. They're hiring these third-party companies that are supposed to do the monitoring. It's obviously not working. It seems that the issue is going to be who's independent, because once you start paying someone, there's there's an opening for corruption. So is there a sense of how going forward it can be ensured that whoever's inspecting these buildings is actually doing it?
The thing is, now the agreement, signed many European companies, big companies, whenever they buy any garment from Bangladesh's factory, which is not complying the safety standards, and if any accident happens, if any worker dies here or anything happens, so they can be sued in their relative countries. If it is an European company in the European, in that country, if it's an American company in America, they'll have the right to sue that company in their relative country.
The BBC's Akbar Hussain in Dhaka, Bangladesh. Akbar, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take a quick break. And then coming up, the president of Historically Black Morehouse College. Did they defuse a controversy ahead of President Obama's visit this week? And we'll find out in 30 seconds, here and now. President Obama will deliver the commencement speech at Historically Black Morehouse College this weekend. The campus is excited, but the school is dealing with some challenges. The all-male student body is reeling over the arrests of four students charged with sexually assaulting women at sister school Spelman College. And then there was a controversy over another commencement speaker. In April, Morehouse invited the Reverend Kevin Johnson, an alumnus, to deliver a sermon. But after Johnson criticized President Obama in a Philadelphia Tribune op-ed piece for having too few African Americans in his cabinet, Morehouse President John Sylvanus Wilson Jr. told Reverend Johnson he would be given a lesser role. Well, that drew protests from alumni and members of the Black Congressional Caucus. Reverend Johnson withdrew his participation. But yesterday, Morehouse College said Reverend Johnson will, after all, deliver the Saturday sermon. And in a statement issued by the school, Johnson commended President Wilson for, quote, continuing the Morehouse traditions of free thought and free speech. Well, Morehouse President Wilson joins us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. President Wilson, crisis averted?
We have a little disruption here, but we're going to work it out because we're Morehouse men, and so we have worked it out.
Well, I can hear in your voice that that's where you want the focus to be, and who wouldn't? Not just the first...
That's right, Robin.
there's no question that that's where you would want the focus to be, but just a little bit more, because we're talking about young Black men who are going to be graduating, and the Reverend Johnson makes pains to point out that he is a huge supporter of the president. But again, he's raising this question of the lack of appointments in the cabinet because he feels it directly is tied to the lack of jobs and opportunities for the Black community, your graduates.
To your point about his appointments, of course, I was one, and we have a number of Morehouse graduates who work in the Obama administration, as I did. We have for years graduated large numbers of African-American males. African-American males are severely underrepresented in higher education. And here we are every year doing a good job with them. So this is a celebration necessarily of Morehouse College.
Well, in fact, your role, you mentioned you worked at the White House, your role had to do with Historically Black Colleges. So this has been a passion of yours for a while. And Morehouse, the only all-male Black college in the country, has hundreds of well-known graduates, Dr. Martin Luther King, former presidential candidate Herman Cain, Spike Lee. But let's shift to just talking about your school and colleges. We had a conversation this week about how Hispanics in many families are right now going to college at record numbers. Mm-hmm. But they're not graduating at the numbers that they should be. I'm looking at Morehouse, and the graduate rates for Morehouse are lower than 40%. Why is that?
Actually, it's closer to 50% four-year. And a lot of students have trouble with finances. So many of our students are taking longer because they cannot come up with all the money they need in four straight years, even with help from federal grants and family help and churches and other sources. It is very difficult.
Is part of it that you are losing some of these students to schools that are, you know, integrated? Is part of this that you're losing some of your student body to other schools?
It's in part that the competition, of course, is stiffer across the board, and the competition for African-American males is especially stiff. I mean, if you're really bright African-American male coming out of America's K through 12 system, whether public or private, you're going to have a lot of colleges and universities after you because African-American males are underrepresented. But right now, 9 out of 10 African-Americans in higher education are being educated outside of HBCUs. I mean, I was in college in the late 70s, and some 7 out of 10 of the African-Americans in higher ed were being educated inside of HBCUs. So the script is completely flipped, and the competition for bright African-American students in general is a lot stiffer across the board. We do have a small population of white students and Hispanic students at Morehouse College, and obviously we'll look at those sectors more as we move to the future.
Well, as a matter of fact, a new study shows that schools like yours and your sister school, Spelman, are attracting more Asian and Latino students.
Correct. And we're going international as well.
Okay, here I go again. We mentioned some of the controversy over the speakers, but the school's also grappling with 2 recent cases of sexual assault, 4 Morehouse students arrested. I know you don't want anything to cloud, you know, this terrific weekend for your seniors, but that was definitely, I'm sure, a dark day. And we know an assembly was called, students were, you know, told about these cases and that it was not acceptable behavior. It's painful when these happen at any school. Is it more painful at a school like Morehouse where there's so much more of a spotlight? You are the only all-black, all-male school in the country.
Morehouse College is about building character. Sometimes at Morehouse, as with any college or university, things happen that are a contradiction to what we are about. It was a tough thing to go through, but what we did in that case followed all procedures and certainly reasserted our values as being against all kinds of violence, building the kind of character in these young men that would ensure that they are not in that position ever.
That's John Sylvanus Wilson, Jr., president of Morehouse College. Before we let you go, I remember going to a funeral a while back. I don't know if you ever knew Jim Smith, who founded the Sportsman's Tennis Clubs here in Boston, and he had a son die. His son had gone to Morehouse. And to see the carloads of his fellow Morehouse grads pull up was quite something.
There is something that most Morehouse students experience at some point during their undergraduate years. It's often referred to as the Morehouse mystique. There's an expectation that you will not only be smart when you leave here, but you have to be good. You have to do something meaningful for the world and in the world. And I think what you see in moments like that, when a Morehouse graduate is hurt or has some tragedy, you see a rallying of other Morehouse men to be a brother, be a friend. And that is part of the Morehouse mystique. That is why the situation with our baccalaureate worked itself out, and that is why we are all now focused on the historic visit by the President of the United States.
And we will let you go to do just that. President Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. By the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, did you hear that terrific story on All Things Considered about the country song Born of a Here and Now interview? We'll link you, but also hear more about that interview tomorrow. Back in a minute, Here and Now. It's Here and Now. Star Trek Into Darkness beamed into theaters at midnight last night, director J.J. Abrams' second movie in his reboot of this sci-fi classic. In this clip, First Officer Spock, played by Zachary Quinto, is trapped in the middle of a volcano that he's trying to freeze to save the planet. He's arguing with Captain Kirk and company aboard the Enterprise because a rescue mission would reveal their presence to the primitive locals, violating Starfleet's vaunted non-interference prime directive.
Our shuttle was concealed by the ash cloud, but the Enterprise is too large. If utilized in a rescue effort, it would be revealed to the indigenous species.
Spock, nobody knows the rules better than you, but there has got to be an exception.
None. Such action violates the prime directive.
Shut up, Spock. We're trying to save you, damn it.
Doctor, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Spock, we're talking about your life!
The rule cannot be broken under any
circumstances.
Something tells me Spock survives, as does Star Trek. Fans geek out over every detail, including a character's name.
By the way, the Klingon does have a name, actually. It's Kras, K-R-A-S, but that was never revealed in the episode.
That's Mission Log, a podcast for which no Star Trek minutia is too small. Rod Roddenberry, Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry's son, is the podcast's executive producer. He joins us from Los Angeles via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me here.
And we're also joined by Ken Ray. He hosts that podcast along with John Champion. He joins us from WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Ken, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
So we want to talk about this podcast, but Rod, you explained in your really well-received documentary, Trek Nation, that you actually only came to understand the impact of your dad's work after he died. So now, obviously, embracing it, you saw the new film. What do you think? Is it continuing your dad's legacy?
I came out very impressed, very happy. And I got to say, this really holds up, I think, more so to the original Star Trek and the Next Generation and the philosophies that were incorporated into that.
Which we're going to hear more about. Ken, you haven't seen the movie. And by the way, Rod, you gave him a real spoiler alert while you guys were waiting to talk.
Yes, I've been trying to throw people off. I just keep telling everyone, no, don't worry, everyone dies in the end. So.
They do not.
Amen.
But Ken, you went to see The Hobbit just so you could see a 9-minute preview of the Star Trek film. What excited you about that preview?
They actually mentioned the Prime Directive more in the first 9 minutes of the new Star Trek movie than they did in the whole first season.
We just heard a little bit about this Prime Directive. What does that mean to you?
Basically letting cultures sort of evolve on their own, letting societies sort of evolve on their own without interference.
Well, we get a sense of how important this is to you, both of you. This is a scene from The Apple. It's from the original series with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy. The Enterprise crew destroys a computer that a local tribe worshipped as a god because it took care of them. Here, William Shatner as Kirk explain why it's a good thing that it's been destroyed.
You learn to build for yourselves, think for yourselves, work for yourselves, and what you create is yours. That's what we call freedom. You'll like it a lot.
Ken, Rod, jump in.
What Kirk says there sounds really humanistic and like the right thing to do, but the entire society was built around this computer, and Kirk goes and just sort of destroys it and says, and you'll be fine on your own. You wonder what's going to happen to them.
He's got a very almost imperialist idea of how everybody should live. If he arrives someplace and society's not running exactly the way he thinks it ought to be, Captain Kirk has no problem turning the whole thing under and making sure it actually runs the way he thinks it ought to. And then he's, he hops on his ship and goes to some other planet and we'll never hear from the feeders of Vol again.
Well, it's true because you could view that one scene as, relevant to today, that we're too tied to our computers and we need to back away and live our own lives and not be dictated by this thing that was supposed to help us. On the other hand, it sounds a little bit like Ayn Rand, when he's telling them, do everything for yourselves. That's freedom. So you could see it from so many perspectives, and frankly, I would not have thought of that.
That is the crazy thing about it. I mean, we've come across so many episodes where we're not arguing about, okay, well, could they actually go warp 8 or would they have to stick at warp 6? I mean, we're actually talking about the nature of happiness and who gets to decide that and, is it actually a thing?
Rod, why did you do this?
The short version is that I've always been on this exploration. As you said, I didn't really start to pay attention and get to know Star Trek or my father until after he passed away. I wanted to learn more about it. And the way to do that was to really go back and look at these shows and try to take them apart and see if I could see what they saw. And listening to John and Ken, they don't go too geeky or too nerdy, but they really kind of look at the ethics and what it means in the bigger picture when a captain or someone in Star Trek does something.
And Rod is sweet, by the way, to say that we're not geeks, because you can't talk about Star Trek for an hour on tape every week and not be a geek.
Well, let's do this again. Another episode you both like is the Corbomite Maneuver. It's from season 1 of the original series. Captain Kurt addresses his crew after receiving a distress signal from a ship that was just trying to destroy them.
First Federation vessel is in distress. We're preparing to board it. There are lives at stake, by our standards, alien life, but lives nevertheless. Captain, out.
That episode actually sort of choked me up. I mean, they have spent this whole time thinking that they're coming up against an implacable foe. And once they actually get the upper hand, the whole crew is ready to turn and run. But they have this code that they live by. They have this mission that they have to do.
that is Star Trek at its best. That is the vision of the future that my father really had in mind, that kind of humanity.
This just prompted a thought for me. I can't believe that this is happening, but in listening to that scene, I was thinking about the huge controversy here in Boston and all the pain on the part of people who didn't want the body of the alleged Boston bomber buried here. And I just heard Captain Kirk speaking, and it was so strange that it prompted in me a thought about a real story that actually happened.
I don't want to go so far as to say hate mail, but I got angry emails because in the Corbomite maneuver, I likened it to our decision to not try certain criminals here on U.S. soil. And that prompted a lot of angry emails from some people saying, you know, you're making this political. Well, no. Gene Roddenberry made this political almost 50 years ago. So for us to look at it now and say, we're not going to apply this to today, I mean, that cheapens it. You might as well be watching Buck Rogers.
We have some Star Trek geeks on staff. Do you mind? Producer Catherine Gorman is here.
Hi, guys. So I just wanted to ask about the sort of undercurrent of sexism that runs pretty deep through the original series and then shows up again in the character of Riker in The Next Generation. How do we square that with these high-minded Starfleet ideals?
I'd say, well, it was the 60s. That's not a very good answer, but...
Riker is sort of the transition of going from the original series to The Next Generation, it seems to me. He's kind of like Captain Kirk 100 years later.
There's definitely a duality there because they do have Uhura as the African-American communications officer who was fourth in command. So I would guess my father might say, as somewhat as the joking excuse, that women just owned their sexuality in the 23rd century. So whether it was a short skirt or long pants, women were free to do and wear what they wanted. And it wasn't a sign of insecurity. It was a sign of strength. A bit of a cop-out, but I like the answer.
Okay, Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you know, by the way, Rod, you mentioned Uhuru, and the black actress tells the great story of how she was thinking of leaving the series, and then she met Dr. Martin Luther King, who said to her, "You can't. Our family watches you. You're our vision of a black in the future. You are in control of your life. You're such a symbol. You mean so much." Again, there's another example.
Yeah, and as much credit as I want to give my father for introducing these ideas, or at least shepherding them along, there were hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of others who simply felt the same way but didn't have the microphone in front of them.
That's Rod Roddenberry, son of Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry. Ken Ray's with us as well. He's co-host of the podcast Mission Log. We'll let you know how you can get to that at hereandnow.org. Rod, Ken, thank you both.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Okay, what do I say? Kevin, what am I supposed to say? Live long and prosper. That's right, I knew that. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.